months ago. It couldn't have been a coincidence, which meant that the photos my grandfather had shown me, that he'd sworn were of children he'd known in this house, had really come from this house. But could that mean, despite the doubts I'd harbored even as an 8-year-old, that the pictures were genuine? What about the fantastic stories that went along with them? That any of them could be true, literally true, seemed unthinkable. And yet, standing there, in dusty half-light, in that dead house that seems so alive with ghosts, I thought, maybe... Suddenly there came a loud crash from somewhere in the house above me, and I startled so badly that all the pictures slipped from my hands. "It's just the house settling," I told myself, "or caving in." But as I bent down to gather the photos, the crash came again. And in an instant, what meager light had shone through the hole in the floor faded away, and I found myself squatting in inky darkness. I heard footsteps, and then voices. I strained to make out what they were saying, but I couldn't. I didn't dare move, afraid that the slightest motion would set off a noisy avalanche of debris all around me. I knew that my fear was irrational. It was probably just those dumb rapper kids pulling another prank. But my heart was beating 100 miles an hour, and some deep animal instinct commanded me to be silent. My legs began to go numb. As quietly as I could, I shifted my weight from one leg to the other to get the blood flowing again. A tiny piece of something came loose from the pile and rolled away, making a sound that seemed huge in the silence. The voices went quiet. Then a floorboard creaked right over my head and a little shower of plaster dust sprinkled down. Whoever was up there, they knew exactly where I was. I held my breath. Then I heard a girl's voice say softly, "Abe, is that you?" I thought I dreamed it. I waited for the girl to speak again, but for a long moment, there was only the sound of rain banking off the roof, like 1,000 fingers tapping way off somewhere. Then, a lantern glowed to life above me, and I craned my neck to see 6 kids kneeling around the craggy jaws of broken floor, peering down. I recognized them somehow, though I didn't know where from. They seemed like faces from a half-remembered dream. Where had I seen them before? And how did they know my grandfather's name? Then it clicked. Their clothes, strange for even whales. Their pale, unsmiling faces. The pictures strewn before me, staring up at me just as the children stared down. Suddenly, I understood. I'd seen them in the photographs. The girl who'd spoken stood up to get a better look at me. In her hands, she held a flickering light, which wasn't a lantern or a candle, but seemed to be a ball of raw flame, attended by nothing more than her bare skin. I'd seen her picture not 5 minutes earlier, and in it, she looked much the same as she did now, even cradling the same strange light between her hands. "I'm Jacob," I wanted to say. "I've been looking for you," but my jaw had come unhinged, and all I could do was stare. The girl's expression soured. I was wretched looking, damp from rain and dust covered, and squatting in a mound of debris. Whatever she and the other children had been expecting to find inside this hole in the floor, I was not it. A murmur passed among them, and they stood up and quickly scattered. Their sudden movement knocked something loose in me, and I found my voice again and shouted for them to wait, but they were already pounding the floorboards toward the door. I tripped through the wreckage and stumbled blindly across the stinking basement to the stairs, but by the time I made it back to the ground floor, where the daylight they'd stolen had somehow returned, they had vanished from the house. I bolted outside and down the crumbling brick steps into the grass, screaming, "Wait! Stop!" But they were gone. I scanned the yard, the woods, breathing hard, cursing myself. Something snapped beyond the trees. I wheeled around to look and, through a screen of branches, caught a flash of blurred movement. the hem of a white dress. It was her. I crashed into the woods, sprinting after. She took off running down the path. I hurdled fallen logs and ducked low branches, chasing her until my lungs burned. She kept trying to lose me, cutting from the path into the trackless forest and back. Finally, the woods fell away and we broke into open bogland. I saw my chance. Now she had nowhere to hide. To catch her, I had only to pour on the speed, and with me in sneakers and jeans and her in a dress, it would be no contest. Just as I started to catch up, though, she made a sudden turn and plunged straight into the bog. I had no choice but to follow. Running became impossible. The ground couldn't be trusted. It kept giving way, tripping me into knee-deep bog holes that soaked my pants and sucked at my legs. The girl, though, seemed to know just where to step, and she pulled farther and farther away, finally disappearing into the mist so that I had only her footprints to follow. After she lost me, I kept expecting her prints to veer back toward the path, but they plowed ever deeper into the bog. Then the mist closed behind me, and I couldn't see the path anymore, and I began to wonder if I'd ever find my way out. I tried calling to her. "My name is Jacob Portman. I'm Abe's grandson. I won't hurt you." But the fog and the mud seemed to swallow my voice. Her footprints led to a mound of stones. It looked like a big gray igloo, but it was a cairn, one of the Neolithic tombs after which Cairnholm was named. The cairn was a little taller than me, long and narrow, with a rectangular opening in one end, like a door, and it rose from the mud on a tussock of grass. Climbing out of the mire onto the relatively solid ground that ringed it, I saw that the opening was the entrance to a tunnel that burrowed deep inside. Intricate loops and spirals had been carved on either side, ancient hieroglyphs, the meaning of which had been lost to the ages. "Here lies Bog Boy," I thought, or more likely, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." But enter I did, because that's where the girl's footprints led. Inside, the cairn tunnel was damp and narrow and profoundly dark, so cramped that I could only move forward in a kind of hunchbacked crab walk. Luckily, enclosed spaces were not one of the many things that scared the hell out of me. Imagining the girl frightened and trembling somewhere up ahead, I talked to her as I went along, doing my best to reassure her that I meant no harm. My words came slapping back at me in a disorienting echo. Just as my thighs were starting to ache from the bizarre posture I'd been forced to adopt, the tunnel widened into a chamber, pitch black, but big enough that I could stand and stretch my arms to either side without touching a wall. I pulled out my phone and once more pressed it into service as a makeshift flashlight. It didn't take long to size up the place. It was a simple stone-walled chamber about as large as my bedroom, and it was completely empty. There was no girl to be found. I was standing there, trying to figure out how the hell she'd managed to slip by, when something occurred to me. Something so obvious that I felt like a fool for having taken this long to realize it. There never was any girl. I'd imagined her, and the rest of them too. My brain had conjured them up at the very moment I was looking at their pictures, and the sudden, strange darkness that had preceded their arrival? A blackout. It was impossible. Anyway, those kids had all died a lifetime ago. Even if they hadn't, it was ridiculous to believe they would still look exactly as they had when the photos were taken. Everything happened so quickly, though. I never had a chance to stop and wonder if I might be chasing a hallucination. I could already predict Dr. Golan's explanation. "That house is such an emotionally loaded place for you. Just being inside was enough to trigger a stress reaction." Yeah, he was a psychobabble-spewing prick, but that didn't make him wrong. I turned back, humiliated. Rather than crab-walking, I let go of the last of my dignity and just crawled on my hands and knees toward the gauzy light coming from the mouth of the tunnel. Looking up, I realized I'd seen this view before, in a photograph in Martin's museum of the place where they'd discovered the Bog Boy. It was baffling to think that people had once believed this foul-smelling wasteland was a gateway to heaven, and believed it with such conviction that a kid my age was willing to give up his life to get there. What a sad, stupid waste. I decided then that I wanted to go home. I didn't care about the photos in the basement, and I was sick of riddles and mysteries and last words. Indulging my grandfather's obsession with them had made me worse, not better. It was time to let go. I unfolded myself from the cramped cairn tunnel and stepped outside only to be blinded by light. Shielding my eyes, I squinted through split fingers at a world I hardly recognized. It was the same bog, and the same path, and the same everything as before, but for the first time since my arrival, it was bathed in cheery yellow sunlight, the sky a candy blue, no trace of the twisting fog that, for me, had come to define this part of the island. It was warm, too, more like the dog days of summer than the breezy beginnings of it. God, the weather changes fast around here, I thought. I slogged back to the path, trying to ignore the skin-crawly feeling of bog mud gooshing into my socks, and headed for town. Strangely, the path wasn't muddy at all, as if it had dried out in just a few minutes, but it had been carpet-bombed with so many grapefruit-sized animal turds that I couldn't walk in a straight line. How had I not noticed this earlier? Had I been in some kind of psychotic haze all morning? Was I in one now? I didn't look up from the turdy checkerboard that stretched out before me until I'd crossed the ridge and was coming back into town, which is when I realized where all the mess had come from. Where this morning, a battalion of tractors had plied the gravel paths, hauling carts loaded with fish and peat bricks up and down from the harbor, now those carts were being pulled by horses and mules. The clip-clop of hooves had replaced the growl of engines. Missing, too, was the ever-present buzz of diesel generators. Had the island run out of gas in the few hours I'd been gone? And where had the townspeople been hiding all these big animals? Also, why was everyone looking at me? Every person I passed stared at me goggle-eyed, stopping whatever they were doing to rubberneck as I walked by. I must look as crazy as I feel, I thought, glancing down to see that I was covered in mud from the waist down and plaster from the waist up, so I ducked my head and walked as fast as I could toward the pub, where at least I could hide in the anonymous gloom until Dad came back for lunch. I decided that when he did, I would tell him straight out that I wanted to go home as soon as possible. If he hesitated, I would admit that I'd been hallucinating and we'd be on the next ferry, guaranteed. Inside the hole were the usual collection of inebriated men bent over foamy pint glasses and the battered tables and dingy decor I'd come to know as my home away from home. But as I headed for the staircase, I heard an unfamiliar voice bark, "Where do you think you're going?" I turned, one foot on the bottom step, to see the bartender looking me up and down. Only it wasn't Kev, but a scowling, bullet-headed man I didn't recognize. He wore a bartender's apron and had a bushy unibrow and a caterpillar mustache that made his face look striped. I might have said, "I'm going upstairs to pack my suitcase, and if my dad still won't take me home, I'm going to fake a seizure." But instead I answered, "Just up to my room?" Which came out sounding more like a question than a statement of fact. "That's so," he said, clapping down the glass he'd been filling. "This look like a hotel to you." Wooden creaks as patrons swiveled around in their stools to get a look at me. I quickly scanned their faces. Not one of them was familiar. "I'm having a psychotic episode," I thought. Right now. This is what a psychotic episode feels like. Only, It didn't feel like anything. I wasn't seeing lightning bolts or having palm sweats. It was more like the world was going crazy, not me. I told the bartender that there had obviously been some mistake. "My dad and I have the upstairs rooms," I said. "Look, I've got the key," and I produced it from my pocket as evidence.
"Let me see that,"
he said, leaning over the counter to snatch it out of my hand. He held it up to the dingy light, eyeing it like a jeweler.
"This ain't our key,"
he growled, then slipped it into his own pocket.
"Now tell me what you really want up there, and this time, don't lie."
I felt my face go hot. I'd never been called a liar by a non-relative adult before. "I told you already, we rented those rooms. Just ask Kev if you don't believe me."
"I don't know no Kev, and I don't fancy being fed stories," he said coolly. "There ain't any rooms to let round here, and the only one lives upstairs is me."
I looked around, expecting someone to crack a smile, to let me in on the joke, but the men's faces were like stone.
"He's American," observed a man sporting a prodigious beard. "Army could be."
"Bullocks," another one growled. "Look at him. He's practically a fetus."
"His Mac, though," the bearded one said, reaching out to pinch the sleeve of my jacket. "You'd have a hell of a time finding that in a shop. Army, gotta be."
"Look," I said, "I'm not in the army, and I'm not trying to pull anything on you. I swear. I just want to find my dad, get my stuff, and..."
"American my arse," bellowed a fat man.
He peeled his considerable girth off a stool to stand between me and the door, toward which I'd been slowly backing.
"His accent sounds rubbish to me. I'll wager he's a Jerry spy."
"I'm not a spy," I said weakly. "Just lost."
"Got that right,"
he said with a laugh.
"I say we get the truth out of him the old-fashioned way, with a rope."
Drunken shouts of assent. I couldn't tell if they were being serious or just taking a piss, but I didn't much care to stick around and find out. One undiluted instinct coursed through the anxious muddle in my brain. Run! It would be a lot easier to figure out what the hell was going on without a room full of drunks threatening to lynch me. Of course, running away would only convince them of my guilt, but I didn't care. I tried to step around the fat man. He made a grab for me, but slow and drunk is no match for fast and scared shitless. I faked left and then dodged around him to the right. He howled with rage as the rest unglued themselves from bar stools to lunge at me, but I slipped through their fingers and ran out the door and into the bright afternoon. I charged down the street, my feet pounding divots into the gravel, the angry voices gradually fading behind me. At the first corner, I made a skidding turn to escape their line of sight, cutting through a muddy yard where squawking chickens dove out of my way, and then an open lot where a line of women stood waiting to pump water from an old well, their heads turning as I flew past. A thought I had no time to entertain flitted through my head. Hey, where'd the waiting woman go? But then I came to a low wall and had to concentrate on vaulting it. Plant the hand, lift the feet, swing over. I landed in a busy path where I was nearly run down by a speeding cart. The driver yelled something derogatory about my mother as his horse's flank brushed my chest, leaving hoof prints in a wheel track just inches from my toes. I had no idea what was happening. I understood only two things, that I was quite possibly in the midst of losing my mind, and that I needed to get away from people until I could figure out whether or not I actually was. To that end, I dashed into an alley behind two rows of cottages, where it seemed there would be lots of hiding places, and made for the edge of town.
I slowed to a fast walk, hoping that a muddy and bedraggled American boy who was not running would attract somewhat less attention than one who was.